them, and he said, "There is a very good maid, not too young, whose father is a scholar, and he has made her into something of a scholar, too, he having no son and needing to teach someone what he knew. She is what they call nowadays a new woman, such as have learning and do not bind their feet, and because she is strange in this way, her marriage has been delayed, because men have not dared to take a woman like this for their sons, lest a trouble come out of it. But I hear there are many like her in the South, and it is only because this is a small, old city, doubtless, that men here do not know what to make of her. She goes on the street, even, and I have seen her once, and she went very decorously, and did not stare about her, either. With all her learning, she is not so hideous as might be feared. And if she is not very young, yet she cannot be more than 25 or 26. Do you think my brother would fancy such a one who was not like a usual woman?" To this Wang the merchant answered with reserve, "But do you think she will make a good housewife and be useful to him? He reads and writes as well as many a man does, and if he did not, he could hire it done for him by some scholar. I do not see that he needs all this learning in a wife." Then Wang the landlord, who had been dipping food into his bowl busily, the serving man having come to and fro many times with dishes, paused and held his porcelain spoon in mid-air full of a soup, and he cried, "He can hire a servant, too, I swear, or a jade, and it is not all in what a woman can do that makes her a good wife. The chief thing is whether or not she fits a man's fancy or not, especially if he is one like my brother who will not seek out other women. Sometimes I think it would be a pleasant thing to tickle a man if his wife could sit and read poetry to him, or some tale of love as he lies on his bed to sleep." But this was distasteful to Wang the merchant, and he picked delicately at a dish of pigeons stewed with chestnuts, and thrust his chopsticks carefully between the bones to find the bit he relished, and he said, "I would rather fit my fancy to a woman careful in the house, and who had children, and who could save money." Then Wang the landlord grew suddenly angry in the willful way he had even since his childhood, and his great full face turned a dark red, and Wang the merchant saw they would never agree on this, and it was not a thing to waste his day upon, for women are but women, whoever they may be otherwise, and one will serve the final purpose of a man as well as another. So he said quickly, "Ah, well, that brother of ours is not poor, and let us choose two wives for him then. Do you choose the one you think best, and we will wed him to her first, and then a while later send him the one I choose. And if he likes one better than the other, let him. But two are not too many for such a man as he in his position." Thus they compromised, and Wang the landlord was pleased that the one he chose was to be the wife, although when he thought it seemed no more than his due, for no man could lie with two wives on his wedding night, and, after all, he was the eldest son in this family and the head. So they agreed, and then parted, and Wang the landlord went bustling to do his part, and Wang the merchant went back to his house to find his wife and talk with her. When he reached his home, she was at the gate, standing in the snowy street, her hands wrapped in her apron to warm them. But ever and again she brought them out to probe the crops of fowls that a vendor had there to sell. The snow had made such fowls cheaper than usual, since they could not find their own food, and she wished to add a hen or two to her stock, and as Wang the merchant came near, she did not look up, but continued to peer at the fowls. But Wang the merchant said to her as he passed, to go into the house, "Have done, woman, come here." Then she made haste and chose two hens, and after quarreling over their weight upon the scales to which the vendor hung them by their legs tied together, they agreed upon the price, and she came into the house and thrust the hens under a chair, and then sat down cornerwise on it to hear what her husband had to say to her. And he said in his dry, scanty way, "That younger brother of mine wants a wife, for his has died suddenly. I know nothing of women, but you have had your eyes hanging out these 2 years looking for wives for our sons. Is there one we could send there?" His wife answered readily, for she delighted in all such things as birth and death and marriage, and her constant talk was of these. "There is a very good maid who lived next door to me in my own village, and she is so good I have often wished that she were young enough for our eldest. She is the pleasantest-tempered maid, and very saving, and she has no fault at all except that her teeth grew black even when she was a child, from some worm that ate them away, it is said, and now they drop out sometimes. But she is ashamed of this, and keeps her lips drawn down to hide them, so they are not easily seen, and because of this she talks very little and very low. Her father is not poor either, and he owns land, and he will be glad to have her wed so well, I know, seeing that she is already a little beyond the age. Then Wang the merchant said dryly, If she cannot talk much, that will be worth something. See to it, and after the wedding we will send her. And he told his wife that two women were to be chosen, and she said loudly, Well, I feel sorry for him if he has to have one of your brothers choosing, for what does he know except lewd women? And I vow if his lady has anything to do with it, she will choose a nunnish creature. For I hear now she is so daft over priests and nuns, she would have the whole house praying and mumming. It is well enough, I say, to go to the temple once in a while if there is someone sick of a fever or if a woman is childless or something. But I dare say the gods are like all of us, and we do not love best the people who are forever troubling us and calling us for this and that. And she spat on the floor and rubbed the place with her foot. And forgetting the hens under her chair, she thrust her feet back and struck them, and they set up a mighty squawking, so that Wang the merchant rose and called out impatiently, "I never saw such a house. Must we have hens everywhere?" And when she reached under hastily to drag the fowls out and explain how the price of them was less than usual now, he broke into what she began to say and said, "Let be, let be. I must go back to my markets. Attend to the thing, and this day, 2 months or so, we will call her. Only keep all the costs well in mind, for the law does not require that we pay over again for my brother's wedding." Thus the thing was done, and the two maids were betrothed, and the deeds drawn up, and Wang the merchant entered the costs carefully into his counting books, and that day, month, was the day set for the wedding. Now the day was near the end of the old year, and Wang the tiger, when he had been told of it, made ready to go to his brother's house to wed once more. He had no heart to do the thing, and yet he had determined he would, and so he gave over any thought or wavering, and he made ready his three trusty men he appointed to watch in his stead, and he left his nephew to be messenger if any trouble should arise while he was gone. When he had done this, he made a feint of asking permission of the old magistrate to leave for 5 days and 6 days for the journey to come and to go, and the old magistrate made haste to give his permission. And Wang the tiger took precaution to tell the old magistrate that he left his army and his trusty men, lest there be some vague hope of rising against him somehow. Then, clothing himself in his next best garments, and taking his best with him in a roll upon his saddle, Wang the tiger went south to his home, taking with him a small guard of 50 armed men, for he was a man of such courage that he did not, as many lords of war do, surround himself with hundreds of inner and outer guards. Through the wintry country Wang the tiger rode, stopping at village inns by night, and riding on again over the frozen earthen roads. There was no sign yet of spring, and the land lay gray and harsh, and the houses made of the gray clay and thatched with the gray straw seemed but part of the land. Even the people, bitten with the winds and dust of the northern winter, were gray of the same hue, and Wang the tiger felt no joy rise in his heart these 3 days, as he rode toward his father's home. When he was come, he went to his elder brother's house, since there he was to be wed. And when he had given them brief greeting, he said abruptly that before he wed, he would do his duty and go to do reverence at his father's grave. And this they all approved, and especially Wang the landlord's lady, for it was a decent, proper thing to do, seeing that Wang the tiger had been so long away, and he had not shared in the regular times that the family paid such respect to their dead. But Wang the tiger, although he knew his duty, and when he could, he did it, now performed it partly because he was restless and dreary in himself, and he did not know why he was either. But he could not bear to sit in his brother's house idle, and he could not bear his brother's unctuous pleasure at the coming wedding. And he was oppressed in himself, and he must needs think of some excuse to be out and away from them all, because this house did not seem his home. He sent a soldier then to buy the paper money and the incense and all such things as are useful to the dead, and with these he went out of the city with the men at his horse's heels, their guns on their shoulders. He took a little faint comfort to see how people stared at him on the street, and although he held his face stiff and stared ahead seeming to see and to hear nothing, still he heard his soldiers shout out roughly, "Way for the general! Way for our lord!" And as he saw the common people shrink back against the walls and into the gateways, he was a little comforted because he was so great to them, and he held himself erect in his state and pomp. Thus he came to the graves under the date tree, which by now had grown knotted and gnarled, Although when Wang Lung had first chosen that place to lay his dead, it was a smooth, young tree. Now other date trees had sprung from it, and Wang the tiger, having dismounted while he was yet a long way off to show his respect, came slowly to these trees, and one of the soldiers stood and held the red horse, and Wang the tiger walked slowly and stately in his reverence until he came to the grave of his father. There he made obeisance 3 times, and the soldiers who carried the money and the incense came forward and arranged it, the most at Wang Lung's grave, and the next at the grave of Wang Lung's father, and the next at the grave of Wang Lung's brother, and the least at Olan's grave, whom Wang the tiger could remember but dimly as his mother. Then Wang the tiger went forward again, in his slow and stately way, and he lit the incense and the paper, and he knelt and knocked his head the number of times he should before every grave. And when this was finished, he stood motionless and meditated, while the fire burned, and the silver and the gold paper turned to ash, and the incense smoldered sharp and fragrant upon the wintry air of that day. There was no sunshine and no wind, a gray, chill day such as may bring snow, and the warm, slight smoke of the incense curled clearly in the chill air. The soldiers waited in completest silence, while their general communed as long as he wished with his father. And at last Wang the tiger turned away, and walked to his horse and mounted it, and went back along the path he had come. But while he meditated, he had not thought at all of his father, Wang Lung. He thought of himself, and of how when he lay dead, there would not be one to come and do him reverence as son to father. And when he thought of this, it seemed well to him that he was to be wed, and he bore a little better the dreariness he had in his soul for the hope of a son. Now the path on which Wang the tiger rode skirted the threshold of the earthen house, and passed by the edge of the threshing floor that was its dooryard. And the noise of the soldiers roused the hunchback youth who lived there with Pear Blossom, and he came hobbling out as quickly as he could, and stood staring. He did not know Wang the tiger at all, or even that this was his uncle, and so he only stood there by the path and stared. For all, he was now nearly 16 years old, and soon to be a man. He stood scarcely taller than a child of 6 or 7, and his back rose curved like a hood behind his head, and Wang the tiger was astonished at the sight of him, and he asked, drawing his horse back, "Who are you who live here in my earthen house?" Then the lad knew him, for he had heard he had an uncle who was a general, and he often dreamed of him, and wondered what he was like. And now he cried out, yearningly, "Are you my uncle?" Then Wang the tiger remembered, and he said slowly, still staring down at the lad's upturned face, "Yes, I have heard somewhere that my brother had a brat like you. Strange, for we are all so straight and strong, and so was my father, too, the straightest, strongest old man, even in his age." Then the lad answered simply, as though it were a thing to which he were long used, and he stared avidly at the soldiers as he said it, and at the high, red horse. "But I was dropped." Then he stretched out his hand toward Wang the tiger's gun, and he peered up out of his strange, aged face, and his little, sad, sunken eyes, and he said eagerly, "I have never held one of those foreign guns in my hand, and I would like to hold it for a moment's time." When he stretched up his hands thus, a little dried, wrinkled hand like an old man's, out of a sudden pity for this poor, warped lad, Wang the tiger handed him down his gun to feel and to look at. And as he waited for the lad to have his fill of it, one came to the door. It was Pear Blossom. Wang the tiger knew her instantly, for she had not changed much except to grow thinner even than she had been, and her face, always pale and egg-shaped, was now covered with fine, thread-like wrinkles drawn lightly into the pale skin. But her hair was as smooth and black as ever. Then Wang the tiger bowed very stiffly and deeply, but without descending from his horse, and Pear Blossom gave a little bow and would have turned quickly away, except that Wang the tiger called out, "Is the fool still living and well?" And Pear Blossom answered in her soft, small voice, "She is well." And Wang the tiger asked again, "Do you have your full due every month?" And she answered again in the same voice, "I thank you. I have all my due." And she held her head down as she spoke and looked at the beaten ground of the threshing floor. And this time when she had answered him, she went swiftly away, and he was left staring at the empty doorway. Then he said suddenly to the lad, "Why does she wear a robe that is like a nun's?" for he had seen without knowing he did that Pear Blossom's gray robes were crossed at her throat as a nun's are. The lad answered, scarcely thinking of what he said, so longing and fixed was his heart upon the gun as he fingered it and smoothed its wood. When the fool is dead, she will go into the nunnery near here and be a nun. She eats no meat at all now, and she knows many prayers by heart, and she is a lay nun already. But she will not leave the world and cut off her hair until the fool dies, because my grandfather left her the fool. Wang the tiger heard this, and he was silent a moment in some vague pain, and at last he said pityingly to the lad,
"What will you do then, you poor hunched ape?"
And the lad made answer, "When she goes into the nunnery, I am to be a priest in the temple. Because I am so young, I must live for a long time, and she cannot wait for me to die too. But if I am a priest, I can be fed, and if I am ill, and I am often ill with this thing I carry on me, then she can come and tend me, since we are kin." This the boy said carelessly. Then his voice changed and grew half-sobbing with some passion, and he looked up at Wang the tiger and cried out, "Yes, I am to be a priest, but oh, I wish that I were straight, and then I would be a soldier, if you would have me, uncle." There was such fire in his sunken dark eyes that Wang the tiger was moved by it, and he answered sorrowfully, for he was a merciful man at heart,
"I would have you gladly, you poor thing, but shaped as you are, what can you be now but a priest?"
And the lad hung his head out of its strange socket, and he said in a small, low voice, "I know it." Without another word, he handed the gun back to Wang the tiger, and he turned and limped away across the threshing floor, and Wang the tiger went on his way to his marriage. This was a strange marriage to Wang the tiger. He was in no burning haste this time, and day and night were alike to him. He went through it all silently and decorously, as he did everything he had to do, unless a rage came over him. But now love and rage seemed forever equally far from his dead heart, and the red-robed figure of the bride was like some dim, distant figure with which he had nothing at all to do. So also with guests, and so the figures of his brothers and their wives and children, and the monstrous fat figure of Lotus, leaning on Cuckoo. Yet he looked at her once too, for she panted as she breathed, she was so heavy with her flesh, and Wang the tiger could hear this thick, gusty breathing as he stood to bow to his elder brothers, and to those who sponsored the woman, and to the guests, and to all those to whom he must bow in ceremony. But when the wedding feast was brought, he scarcely tasted this dish or that, and when Wang the landlord began his jokes, since there should be merriment even at a man's second wedding, and when a guest took up the laughter, it died away into feebleness and silence before Wang the tiger's grave face. He said nothing at all at his own wedding feast, except that when the wine was brought he took up the bowl quickly, as though he were thirsty. But when he had tasted it, he set the bowl down again, and he said harshly,
"If I had known the wine would be no better than this, I would have brought a jar of the wine of my own region."
After the days of wedding were over, he mounted his red horse and went away, and he did not cast one look behind him at the bride and her serving-maid who came behind him in a mule cart, with the curtains drawn. No, he rode on as seeming solitary as he had been when he came, his soldiers at his heels, and the cart lumbering behind them. Thus Wang the tiger brought his bride to his own regions, and in a month or two, and a little more, the second woman came under her father's care, and her he received also, since one or two were the same to him. Then the new year drew on, and its festivals and these passed, and it was the time when spring first begins to stir in the earth, although no sign of it could yet be seen in any leaf upon a tree. Yet there were signs, too, for the snow, if it came on a chill gray day, did not lie, but melted in the sudden heat of a warm wind that blew fitfully out of the south, and the wheat plants in the fields, while they did not yet grow, took on a fresher green. And everywhere farmers stirred themselves out of their winter idleness, and looked to their hoes and their rakes, and fed their oxen a little better to prepare them for labor. By the roadsides the weeds began to send up shoots, and children roamed everywhere with their knives and pointed bits of wood and tin, if they had not knives, to dig the fresh green stuff for food. So also did the lords of war bestir themselves in their winter quarters, and soldiers stretched their full-fed bodies and wearied of their gaming and brawling and idling about towns where they were entrenched, and they stirred themselves to wonder what their fortunes could be in the new wars of the spring. and every soldier dreamed a little, and hoped that one above him might be killed and give him place. So also did Wong the Tiger dream of what he would do. Yes, he had a scheme, and it was a good one, and now he could put himself to it, for it seemed to him that his gnawing, nagging love was dead, or if not dead, then buried somewhere, and whenever he was troubled by its memory, he went deliberately to one of those two wives of his, and if his flesh lagged, he drank wine deeply to rouse it. And being a very just man, he showed no favor to one wife above the other, although they were very different, too, the one learned and neat and pleasing in a plain and quiet way, and the other somewhat uncouth, but still a woman of virtue and of good heart. Her greatest fault was her blackened teeth, and that she had a very foul breath if any came near her. But even so, Wong the Tiger was fortunate in that they did not quarrel, these two women. Yet, doubtless, his justice helped this, for he was scrupulous, and he went to them each in turn, and the truth was they were the same to him, and alike nothing. But he need no longer lie alone unless he wished. Still, he never grew familiar with either woman, and he always went into them haughtily and for a set purpose, and he made no speech with them, and there was no frankness as there had been between him and the one dead, and he never gave himself freely. Sometimes he pondered on this difference that a man may feel toward women, and when he did, he told himself bitterly that the one dead had never been truly frank with him. No, not even when she seemed as free as a harlot. For all the time she hugged her design against him in her heart. When he thought of this, Wong the Tiger sealed his heart again, and calmed his flesh with his two wives. And he had this for a hope, and for a fresh light to his ambition, and it was that from one of the twain, surely he might have his son at last. In this hope, Wong the Tiger encouraged his dreams of glory once more, and he swore that in this very year, in this very spring, he would go forth to a great war somewhere, and win for himself power and wide territories. And he saw the victory already his own.
Chapter 22.
Then as spring blossomed, and the white cherry trees and the pale pink peach blooms lay like light clouds over the green land, Wong the Tiger took counsel with his trusty men as to war, and they waited for two things. The first was to see how the war would renew itself between the lords of North and South, for the truce they had made the year before was very slight and tenuous, and it was but a truce of the winter, when it is not convenient to do battle in wind and snow and mud. Aside from this, the lords of North and South so differed in their nature, the one being large in body and slow and fierce, and the other little tricky men, good in guile and ambush, that with such difference in temper and even in blood and language, it was not easy for them to agree upon long truce. The other thing for which Wong the Tiger waited, and his trusty men with him, was for the return of the many spies he sent out early in the year. And while they waited, Wong the Tiger took counsel with his trusty men as to what territory they might attach to what they had, and so enlarge the region. Now they took counsel together in the great room which Wong the Tiger used for his own, and there they sat, each according to his rank, and the hawk said, "North we cannot go, for we are in allegiance with the North." And the pig butcher said loudly, for it was his way to speak whatever the hawk said like a rude echo, for he did not like to be thought less wise than the hawk, and yet he himself could not think easily of a new thing, to say,
"Yes, but even so, it is a very poor and meager land there, and the pigs are so accursed and so thin, they are no use butchering. I have seen those pigs, and I swear their backs are sharp as curved scythes, and a sow's pigs can be counted before ever she gives them birth. It is not a country anyone wants to wage a war to gain."
But Wong the Tiger said slowly,
"Yet south we cannot go, for if we do, we will strike my own and my father's folk, and a man cannot tax his own people freely and with an easy mind."
Now the hair-lipped man spoke little, and never until the others had their say out. And now he said in his turn,
"There is a region where my native land once was, but it is nothing to me now, and it is to the southeast of this, between here and the sea. A very rich country, and one end of it lies against the sea. There is a whole county spread out edgewise along a river there that flows to the sea too, and it is a good country, full of fields, and it has a low ridge of hills, and the river is full of fish. The county seat is the only large town, but there are many villages and market towns, and the people are thrifty and do well."
Wang the Tiger heard this, and he said, "Yes, but such a good place is not likely to be without its lord of war. Who is it?"
Then the trusty man named the name of one who had once been a robber chief, and the very year before this had thrown in his lot with the South. When he heard this name, Wang the Tiger decided swiftly that he would go against this robber chief, and he remembered to this day how he hated the men of the South, and how tasteless their soft rice and peppered meats had been, and there was nothing for a man to set his good teeth down upon to chew it, and he remembered the hateful years of his youth, and he cried out,
"The very place and the very man, for it will enlarge me, and it will count in the general wars as well."
As swiftly as this was the thing decided, and Wang the Tiger shouted to a serving man to bring wine, and they all drank, and Wang the Tiger gave his commands that the soldiers were to be prepared for movement, and they were to march to the new lands as soon as the first spies returned, to tell of what the great war was to be this year. Then the trusty men rose to take their leave and to fulfill these commands, but the hawk lingered after the others went away, and he leaned and whispered into Wang the Tiger's ear, and his voice was hoarse and his breath hot upon Wang the Tiger's cheek, and he said,
"We must let the soldiers have the usual days of looting after the battle, for they mutter among themselves, and they complain that you hold them in so tight, and they do not have the privileges under your banner that other lords of war give. They will not fight if they cannot loot."
Then Wang the Tiger gnawed the stiff black hair he had let grow these days about his lips, and he said very unwillingly, for he knew the hawk was right,
"Well, then tell them they are to have the 3 days when the victory is ours, but no more."
The hawk went away well pleased, but Wang the Tiger sat sullen for a while, for the truth was he hated this looting of the people, and yet what else could he do, seeing that soldiers will not risk their lives to fight without this reward? So although he agreed to it, he was ill at ease for a time, for he could not but see in his mind the picture of the suffering of those people, and he cursed himself for a man too soft for the trade he had chosen. And he forced himself to be hard, and he told himself that after all it must be the rich who lose most, since the poor have nothing of worth to anyone, and the rich can bear it. But he was ashamed, he was so weak, and not for anything would he have had a man of his know he shrank from seeing pain, lest he be despised. Then the spies returned, one after the other, and each in his turn reported to their general, and they said that although no war as yet was broken forth, yet the lords of north and of south were buying weapons from outer countries, and war must come, for everywhere armies were being enlarged and strengthened. Now when Wang the Tiger heard this, he decided that he would begin without delay upon his own private war, and on that very day he commanded his men to assemble themselves upon a field outside the city gates, for there was so vast a number they could not gather together inside. And he rode there upon his high red horse with his bodyguard behind him, and to his right his pocked nephew sat, no longer upon an ass, but now upon a good horse, for Wang the Tiger had given him a position there. And Wang the Tiger held himself erect and exceedingly proud, and his men all stared at him in silence, for indeed he was such a warrior as is not often seen in the world, for great good looks and heavy fierce brows, and on his lips the hair he had let newly grow made him look older than his 40 years. Thus before them he sat motionless, and he let them stare at him a while. And suddenly he lifted his voice out in a shout, and he called to all his men,
"Soldiers and heroes, tomorrow 6 days and we will march to the southeast, and we will take that region. It is a rich and fertile land bordering upon a river and the sea, and what I gain there I will share with you. You are to divide under my 2 trusty men, and the hawk will lead from the east and the pig butcher from the west. I myself, with my picked 5,000 men, will wait to the north, and when you have attacked from 2 sides and hold the city fast, which is the center to the region, I will rush in and close and crush the last resistance. There is a lord of war there, but he is only a robber, and well you have shown me how you can deal with robbers, my good fellows."
Then he added, but very unwillingly, although he had hardened himself for it,
"If you are victorious, you are to have freedom in that city for 3 days. But on the dawn of the 4th day, your freedom ends,
He who does not answer the call of the bugles I shall cause to be blown for a sign to you, him will I kill. I am not afraid to die and not afraid to kill. These are my commands. You have them."
Then the men shouted out, and they stirred restlessly, and as soon as Wong the Tiger had gone away, they grew very eager and greedy and anxious to be off. And every man looked to his weapons and cleaned and sharpened all, and he counted the bullets he had. At that time many a man bartered with others for bullets, and those who were weak in their desire for wine or for a turn at a wench paid over their bullets as far as they dared for that which they yearned. On the dawn of the sixth day, Wong the Tiger led his mighty army out of the city. Yet great as it was, he left a small half behind, and he went to the old magistrate who now lay on his bed and never rose from it, he grew so weak. And Wong the Tiger told the old man that he left the army to protect him and his court. The magistrate thanked him in his feeble, courteous way, but well he knew the army was left a guard upon him still. And the hair-lipped man was its head, and it was a hard place, for the soldiers were discontented to be left behind, and Wong the Tiger was compelled to promise them a dole of extra silver if they did well and guarded faithfully, and he promised them that the next war would be theirs. So they were content a little, or at least less discontent. Then at the head of his army Wong the Tiger went out, and he caused it to be told among the city people that he went to wage war again for them against an encroaching enemy from the south. And the people were afraid and eager to please him, and the guild of merchants there gave him a sum for a gift, and many from the city followed the army as they left the city that day, and they stayed to see Wong the Tiger's ensign set up, and the sacrifice made to it of a killed pig, and incense, so that good fortune might attend the war. When this was over, Wong the Tiger went on in good earnest, and he had not only his men and their weapons to wage the war, but he had brought a goodly sum of silver, too, for he was too clever a general to plunge at once into battle, and he would parley and wait and see how silver could be used. And at least if silver was useless, at first in the end it might serve something, and buy over some important man to open the gates of the city to them. It was now the middle of spring, and the wheat was 2 feet high or so over miles of that countryside, and ready to hand. And Wong the Tiger cast his eyes far and wide over that green land as he rode. He had a pride in its beauty and fruitfulness, for it was his own to rule, and he loved it as a king may love his realm. Yet he was wise, and with all his eye for its beauty, he could keep his wits sharp for some new place to fix attacks to maintain this vast army he now had, and for his private store he must increase also. Thus he passed out of his own region, and when he had come far enough south, so that he came to groves of pomegranate trees, and saw them putting out from their gnarled gray branches the tiny flame-colored new leaves that come late and after all other trees are leaved, he knew he was in the new lands. He looked everywhere then to see what these were, and everywhere he saw fruitful, nurtured fields, and well-fed beasts and fat children, and he rejoiced at it all. But as he passed with his men, the folk upon the lands looked up at them and scowled to see them, and women who had been the moment before talking and laughing in their gossip together grew silent and pale and stared, and many a mother put her hand over her child's eyes. And if the soldiers burst into some song of war, as they did often when they marched, then men in the fields cursed aloud to hear the quiet air broken like this. The very dogs rushed furiously out of the villages to nip the strangers, and when they saw so vast a horde they were dismayed, and shrank away with their tails curled under their bellies. Every now and again an ox broke loose from where it was tied, and fled as fast as it could because of the noise of so many men passing. And sometimes if it were yoked it ran plow and all, and the farmer plowman after it. Then the soldiers guffawed loudly, but Wong the Tiger, if he saw it, stopped courteously until the man had his beast in hand again. In the towns and hamlets also, the people were silent and stricken when the soldiers came pushing through the gates, clamoring and laughing, and hungry for tea and wine and bread and meat, and shopkeepers scowled over their counters because they feared their wares gone and they not paid for them, so that some drew the wooden doors over their open shops as though the night were come. But Wong the Tiger had early given command that nothing should be seized without payment, and he had given his men money for such things as they needed to eat and to drink. Yet well he knew that the best general cannot control so many thousands of lawless men, and although he had told his captains he would hold them responsible, yet he knew no small amount of evil must surely be done, and he could only shout, "If I hear of it, I will kill you!" And he trusted that the men would subdue themselves somewhat, and he did not try to hear everything. But Wong the Tiger planned this way to control his men to some degree. When they had come to a town, he made them stay in a suburb, and he went with only a few hundred first, and he sought the richest merchant in that place. When he had found him, he commanded him to gather together the other merchants, and he waited in the richest merchant's shop. When they were all there before him, very fearful and courteous, then Wong the Tiger was courteous too, and he said, "Do not fear that I shall be extortionate and take more than I ought. It is true I have many thousands of men in the suburb, but give me only a fair amount for my expense on this march, and I will lead my men on, and we will not stay here but the night." Then the merchants, all pale and fearful, would put forward the spokesman they had chosen, and he would stammer forth a sum, but Wong the Tiger knew well it was the lowest they could name, and he would smile coolly, but he drew down his brows while he smiled, and he said, "I see the fine shops you have, the oil shops and the grain markets, and the silks and the cloths, and I see your people how well they are fed and clothed, and how good your streets are. Do you cry your town so small and poor as this? You shame yourselves by such a sum." Thus courteously he would force their sum upward, and he never threatened them coarsely, as some lords of war do, and cry out that he would set his soldiers free in the town if he did not get so much and so much. No, Wong the Tiger used only fair means, for he always said that these men must live too, and they ought not to be asked for more than in reason they ought to be able to give. And the end of it, and the fruit of his courtesy, was that he had that for which he asked, and the merchants were glad to be rid of him so easily, and rid of his hoard. Thus Wong the Tiger marched his men to the southeast, where the sea was, and each time he stopped in a town he had a sum of money the merchants gave him, and at dawn he went on, and the people were glad. But in poor hamlets or small villages, Wong the Tiger did not ask for anything unless it were a little food, and the least he could take. 7 days and 7 nights did Wong the Tiger thus lead his men, and at the end of those days he was even somewhat enriched by the sums of money he had had, and his men were all in great high heart, and well fed, and very hopeful. At the end of the 7 days he was within less than a day's journey of the city he planned to take as the heart to this whole region, and he rode to a low hill from where he could see it. There that city lay like a treasure encircled by its wall, and set into the rolling green fields, and Wong the Tiger's heart leaped to see it so beautiful and under so fair a sky. There the river ran also, as he had heard it did, and the south gate of the city touched the river, so the city seemed like a jewel hung upon a silver chain. In greatest haste then did Wong the Tiger send his messengers to that city guarded with 1,000 men, and he declared to the Lord of War who held that city that he who was Wong the Tiger had come down out of the north, and he came to save the people from a robber. And if the robber would not withdraw peacefully and for a sum to be named, then must Wong the Tiger march against the city with his tens of thousands upon thousands of brave armed men. Now the Lord of War in that place was a very doughty old robber, and he was so black and hideous a man that the people had nicknamed him after the fearful black god, who stands in the entrance halls of temples to be guardian there. So the Lord of War was called Liu, the Gate God. When he heard the boldness of this message that Wong the Tiger had sent, he fell into a mighty rage, and he bellowed with his wrath a while before he could give an answer. And when he could, he answered thus, "Go back and tell your master that he may fight if he wishes. Who fears him? I've never heard of this little dog who calls himself Wong the Tiger." The messengers returned then, and repeated this faithfully to Wong the Tiger, and he was mightily angry in his turn, and he was secretly hurt, that the Lord of War said he had never heard the name of Wong the Tiger, and he wondered within himself if he were less than he thought. But outwardly he ground his teeth together in his black beard, and he called to his men, and they marched against the city that very day, and encamped themselves all about it. But the gates were locked against them, so that they could not go in, and Wong the Tiger bade his men quarter themselves until dawn. And he had a row of tents put up around the city moat, so that his men could watch to see what the enemy did and bring him the news. Now at dawn Wong the Tiger rose very early, and he roused his guard, and all his men were called by the blowing of bugles and drums. And when they were assembled, Wong the Tiger gave his commands that they were to be ready for battle when he called, even though it might be that they waited for a month or two. Then with his guard he went to a hill that was to the east of the city, and there was an old pagoda there, and he climbed up into it and his men he left below to guard him and to terrify the few old priests that were in a temple there. And he saw that while the city was not large, perhaps with not more than 50,000 souls or more, still the houses were well built and the roofs were of a dark tile, and piled upon each other like scales upon a fish's back. He went down then and back to his men, and he led them across the moat. But as he did so, a shower of shots dropped from the high city wall, and Wong the Tiger withdrew again in haste. Wong the Tiger could do no more then but wait, and he took counsel with his captains, and these counseled a siege, for a siege is surer than a battle, since people must eat. This seemed a good thing to Wong the Tiger also, because his men must of a certainty be killed if he attacked the city now, and the gates were so strong, and the great beams so joined together with plates of iron, that Wong the Tiger did not know how to prevail against them. Moreover, if they guarded the locked gates so that no food could go in day after day, after a month or two the enemy must be weakened and submit, whereas if they fought now, the enemy would be strong and well fed, and it could not be said certainly where the victory would turn. Thus Wong the Tiger reasoned, and it seemed to him the better thing to wait until he could do battle and be sure of victory. Therefore he ordered his soldiers to guard that whole city wall, but to stand back from it far enough so that shots could not reach them, but would fall harmlessly into the moat. The soldiers did so encircle the walls, and no one could come out or go in, and the soldiers fed on the produce of the land about there, and they ate the fowls and the vegetables and the fruits and the grains that the farmers had. And since they paid something for all they took, the farmers did not join against them, and Wong the Tiger's army fared very well. The summer came on in its season, and the land was good, and the season was prosperous, for it was in these parts a year neither dry nor wet, although it was rumored that toward the west no rains had fallen behind the mountains, and there would be famine in that place. When Wong the Tiger heard this, he said to himself that again his good destiny was over him, and that there was plenty here for him. Thus a month passed and more, and Wong the Tiger waited day after day in his tent, and no one came out of that locked city. And he waited 20 more days, and he grew very impatient, and so did his men also. But the foe was doughty still, and if they went across the moat, shots still popped out from the city wall. Wong the Tiger wondered very much, and he said in his anger, "What can they have left to eat that anyone has yet the strength to hold his weapon?" And the hawk, who stood by, spat in admiration of so good and brave an enemy, and wiping his mouth on his hand, he said, "They must by now have eaten the dogs and the cats and the beasts of every kind, and even the rats to be caught in their houses." Thus the days passed, and there came no sign out of the besieged city until the end of the second month of summer. Then, as Wong the Tiger went out one morning, as he did every day, to see if there were any smallest change, he saw a white flag waved above the north gate where he was encamped. And in great haste and excitement, he bade a man of his raise a white flag too, and he exulted, for he thought the end was come. Then the north gate opened a little, and only wide enough to let one man through, and it was shut, and they could hear the scraping of the iron bars. And Wong the Tiger watched breathless on the other side of the moat where his camp was, and he saw a young man walking slowly toward him, carrying a white flag upon a bamboo pole. Then Wong the Tiger called to his men to stand in line, and he took his place and just behind, and they waited for the man. And he came near, and he called out when he could be heard, "I come to talk of peace, and we will pay you a sum and all we have, if you will go away in peace." Then Wong the Tiger laughed his noiseless laugh, and he said, sneering, "Do you think I have come so far for money alone? I can get money in my own regions. No! Your lord of war must surrender to me, for I need this city and this region, and it shall be part of my own." Then the young man leaned upon his pole, and he looked at Wong the Tiger with a look of death, and he entreated, saying, "Have mercy, and take your men away." And he fell on his face before Wong the Tiger. But Wong the Tiger felt his anger begin to creep up in him, as he always did when he was opposed, and he was roused, and he shouted, "I will never go away until the land is mine." Then the young man rose, and he threw back his head proudly, and he said, "Then stay, and spend your life here, for we can bear it." and without another word he turned back toward the gate. Then Wong the Tiger felt his old black anger come up in him, and he said to himself that he was amazed that an importunate enemy should send so discourteous a messenger, who had not even performed any rites of courtesy. And to himself he thought that this was the most impudent young man he had ever seen. And the more he thought, the more angry he grew. And suddenly, and before he knew it clearly himself, he was furious, and he called to a soldier, "Lift me your gun and shoot that fellow!" The soldier obeyed instantly, and he shot very well, for the young man fell face down upon a narrow bridge that crossed the moat, and his flag fell into the water, and the pole floated idly upon the surface of the moat, and the whiteness of the flag was sullied with the muddy stream. Then Wong the Tiger commanded his men to run forward and fetch the young man, and they did, running swiftly lest a shot come down from the wall. But not one did come, and Wong the Tiger marveled a little and wondered what this might mean. But he wondered still more when the young man lay before him dead and fast turning the hue of death, for this young man was not starving at all. No, when Wong the Tiger ordered his clothes to be stripped from him so that he might see his flesh, there the young man lay, not fat but still filled out well, so that it could be seen he had been fed with something. Then was Wong the Tiger somewhat dashed at the sight, and he was discouraged for the moment, and he cried, "If this fellow is as fat as he is, what have they to eat that they can last so well against me?" And he cursed and said, "Well, and I can spend my life at this as well as they can." Because he was so angry from this day, he commanded his soldiers to make themselves easy and to take their comfort. And thereafter, when he saw them taking food or goods from the people in the suburbs about that city, or from farming folk here and there, he did not stop them as he once would have. And when a farmer came to complain, or any came to swear against a soldier that he had come into a private house and done what he should not, Wong the Tiger said sullenly, "You are an accursed lot, you people, and I believe you are sending food secretly into this city, or else how can they be so long fed?" But the farmer swore they were not, and many times one would say piteously, "What do we care what lord is over us? And do you think we love this old robber who has kept us half-starved with his taxes? Sir, if you will only treat us with mercy and keep your men back from evil, we will even be glad to have you in his place." But Wong the Tiger grew surly as the summer wore on, and he cursed the heat and the myriads of flies that breeded upon the piles of filth the many soldiers must make, and the mosquitoes that came out of the stagnant moat, and he thought with impatience of the city where his own courts were, and where his two wives waited for him. And all his anger made him not so kind as he had been, and his men grew very lawless, and he let them be so. There came one night in the time of the great heat, a very hot, bright, moonlit night, and Wong the Tiger walked outside his tent for coolness, for he could not sleep. He walked alone except for his bodyguard, who strolled yawning and half asleep behind him as he walked to and fro. And Wong stared as he ever did at the walls of the city, and they stood high and black in the moonlight, and it seemed unconquerable to him. And as he stared, he grew very angry again, and indeed his anger was never cooled in these days, and he swore to himself very bitterly that he would make every man and woman, and even the children in the city, suffer for all the discomfort of this war he was waging. At that moment he saw a moving spot upon the blackness of the wall, a spot more black and moving downward. He stared and stood still. At first he could not believe he saw it, but the longer he stood and stared, the more he could see that there was something small and dark moving like a crab among the vines and the dry small trees that clung to that old wall. At last he saw that it was a man. Yes, the man reached the bottom, and he dropped and came out into the moonlight, and Wong the Tiger saw that he waved a white cloth. Then Wong the Tiger commanded that one go to meet him bearing a white flag also, and he commanded that the man be brought to him, and he stood and waited there, and he strained his sight to see what this man was. When the man was come, he threw himself at Wong the Tiger's feet and beat his head on the ground to beg for mercy. But Wong the Tiger shouted, "Stand him on his feet and let me see him." Two soldiers came forward then and lifted the man, and Wong the Tiger stared. And as he stared, he grew so angry that he felt a thickness in his throat, for this man was not yet starved. No, gaunt he was, and very thin and black, but he was not starved, and Wong the Tiger bellowed,
"Are you come to surrender the city?"
And the man said, "No, the chief will not surrender yet, for he still has food, and we who are about him have some food given us every day. The people starve, it is true, but we can let them, and we are able to hold out yet a while, and we hope for help from the south, for we have let a man over the wall secretly to go for it." At this, Wong the Tiger felt very insecure, and he said doubtfully, holding back his anger as best he could,
"Why have you come, if not to surrender?"
And the man said sullenly,
"I do come only for my own sake. The general under whom I serve has used me very ill. Yes, he is only a coarse and hateful creature, wild and untutored, and I am a man of gentle blood. My father was even a scholar, and I am used to courtesy. He has put me to great shame before my own soldiers. Now, a man may forgive much, but he can never forgive being put to shame. And it is insult not only to me, but to my ancestors, for whom I stand in these times. And his ancestors were, if he knows them at all, such as would be held serfs by mine."
"But how could he put you to such shame as this?" asked Wong the Tiger,
and he was secretly much astonished at this turn. And the man answered with a sullen passion,
"He belittled me for the way I held my gun, and this is my greatest skill, and I can fell what I aim for without a miss."
Then a light began to come over Wong the Tiger, for well he knew that laughter and belittling can breed the bitterest hatred in a man's heart even against a friend, and a man will do anything for revenge if shame is put on him, especially if he be a high, proud fellow such as this man was in his looks. And Wong the Tiger said plainly,
"Tell me what your price is."
Then the man looked about him, and here were the soldiers of Wong the Tiger's bodyguard, listening and their mouths ajar, and he bent and whispered,
"Let me go into your tent with you, where I can speak out."
Then Wong the Tiger turned and strode into his tent, and he commanded the man to be brought there, and he left no more soldiers with him than 5 or 6 or so, to guard against possible treachery from this man. But there was no treachery in this one, only revenge. And so Wong the Tiger found, for the man said,
"I am so filled with hatred and rage that I am willing to climb back over the wall and open the gate to you, and I ask only one thing, that you will take me under your own banners, and the few men who follow me, whom I do not hate, and protect us, lest if the robber is not killed, I shall be sought for and killed, for he is a bitter enemy."
But Wong the Tiger would not have such generous help free and unrewarded with no more than this, and so he said, looking hard at the man as he stood before him between the two soldiers who held him,
"You are a very proper man not to bear insult, and no good fellow will. I am glad to have so good and brave a man with me. Go back, then, and tell your fellows and all the soldiers that I will take them under my own banners, all who surrender themselves and their guns, and not one of them shall be killed. As for you, you shall be a captain in my army, and I will give you 200 pieces of silver, and 5 pieces to every man with his gun that you bring also."
Then the man's twisted face lightened, and he cried warmly,
"You are such a general as I have been searching for all my life long, and I will surely open the gate to you at the moment when the sun is at its zenith, on this very day now dawning."
With this the man turned abruptly and went back, and Wong the Tiger rose and went out of his tent, and watched the man as he climbed nimbly and skillfully over the wall, catching hold of the roots and the gnarled trees as a monkey might, and so he climbed and disappeared over the wall. By now the sun rose like a copper rim over the edge of the fields, and Wong the Tiger commanded his men to be roused, but quietly, and without any noise, lest some enemy see a commotion and suspect a new plan. But many of the men knew already that one had come out of the city, and they had risen in the night and made ready without lighting a single torch. And indeed the light of the moon had been so bright that it was like a pale sun, and the men could see such things even as how their triggers were set, and where a string should pass through the eyelet of a shoe. By full sunrise every man was in his place, and Wong the Tiger gave orders that to each meat should be given to eat, and a full deep drink of wine to make his heart warm and brave. And thus fed and comforted, the soldiers waited for the drum to beat that would send them forward. Then as the sun rose high and full, and beat down with a breathless heat upon the plain where the city lay, Wong the Tiger shouted from where he stood, and his men gathered as they had been told to do in 6 long lines. And when they heard their general shout, every man shouted also, and the noise ran like an echo among them. And as they shouted, every man lifted his weapon in his hands, each man a gun and a knife, and they all ran forward. Some crossed the moat by the bridge, but many ran across the shallow moat and clambered dripping up the further bank, and they pressed against the city wall and clustered about the north gate. But the captains would not let Wong the Tiger stand too near the front, for they did not know at this last moment whether the man would be true or not, and whether there would be treachery. Yet Wong the Tiger trusted the man because he knew that revenge is the surest sword of hatred. Thus they waited, and not a sound came out of that city, and there was no sound of guns upon the city wall. Then, as the sun swung upwards into its place in the zenith, Wong the Tiger stood stiff and watching, and he saw that great iron gate swing a little, and one stooped and peered, and there was a little crack of light along its top. He shouted once, and they rushed forward, and Wong the Tiger with them, and they pressed against the gate and burst it wide, and they poured into the streets of that city like water freed from a dam, and the siege was ended. Then Wong the Tiger did not stand a moment, but he commanded to be led instantly to the palace where the robber chief lived, and he shouted and roared at his men that they were not free yet, and not until he had found the old chief. Then swiftly, because of the haste of their greed, his men hurried him to that palace, asking as they went and laying ruthless hold on any terrified man they saw. But when Wong the Tiger entered the courts of that palace with a great flourish of drums and bugles, it was empty, for the robber chief had fled. How he had known of the betrayal could not be said, but as Wong the Tiger's men had poured into the north gate, the old robber and his loyal followers escaped out of the south gate and were fleeing across the countryside. Wong the Tiger, hearing this from soldiers who had not gone with him, rushed upon the south wall of the city and looked out, and far in the distance he could see but a flying cloud of dust. He was in two minds for a while whether or not to pursue it, but it came to him that he had what he wanted, and it was the city and the key to this region, and what did a robber and his few men mean? So he went down then and back into the deserted palace, and there the many soldiers of the enemy who were left came to do obeisance and to beg his protection. He was pleased to see their number, for they came to him as he sat in the chief hall, and they came in tens and in twenties, the thinnest, most haggard men he had ever seen except in famine years. But they had their weapons, and when they knelt before him and held out their hands to show their submission, Wong the Tiger accepted them, and ordered that every man be fed as much as he was able to eat, and that he be given 5 pieces of silver. But when the man who had betrayed the robber chief came in at the head of his company, Wong the Tiger gave him the 200 pieces of silver he had promised him, and he gave it with his own hands, and he commanded that captain's guard be brought and given to the man too. Thus did Wong the Tiger remember what the man had done for him, and he rewarded him and took him into his own ranks. When this was all finished, then Wong the Tiger knew that the time had come when he must redeem his promise to his men, for he had held them as long as he could, and they would not be longer held. And Wong the Tiger gave the command for their freedom, wishing he need not while he did. It was a strange thing that now that he had what he wanted, his anger against the people was gone, and he shrank from making them suffer. Yet he must keep his word, too, to his men. And when he had given them their freedom for 3 days, he shut himself into the palace and closed the gates, and he was alone except for his bodyguard. Yet even these 100 men or so were very restless and demanded their turn, and at last Wong the Tiger had to tell them off and call others back in their place. And when these others came in with their eyes all red and lustful, and their faces dark and flushed so that they could not subdue their wild looks, Wong the Tiger turned his eyes away, and he would not think of what was going on in that city. When his nephew, whom he kept always by him, grew curious to go out and see what was to be seen, Wong the Tiger burst out on him, glad of one on whom he could with reason fix his anger, and he roared, "Shall my own blood go ravening out like these coarse and common men?" And he would not let the young man move out of his sight, and kept him busy about his person, fetching this or that to eat or to drink, or some change he must have in his garments. And when weak cries came through even into the fast-closed courts, Wong the Tiger was more imperious and more angry than ever with his nephew, so that the youth was kept all in a sweat with his uncle's temper, and he did not dare to answer him a word. The truth was that Wong the Tiger could not be cruel unless he was angry, and indeed this was a weakness.